It was 1971, and one of the potential customers that we had in the steel business, my partner said, you'll never get him to buy any steel. And I said, how do you figure that? And he says, because he never bought any steel from me. So what I did was I bugged him like once a month religiously. So I told our driver one day, I said, put 1,000 pounds of half inch round on the truck and deliver it to this company. What about the paperwork? And I said, don't put any paperwork him. And about a month later, I get a phone call from the owner of the company. He says, what's the idea? I said, what do you mean, what's the idea? He said, you sent me a bunch of steel up here and I didn't order it. And I said, well, did you already use it? And he said, yeah. He said, am I supposed to pay for it? And I said, no, it was a gift. So what now? And he said, I guess you're going to try to sell me some steel. And I said, yeah, I am. He started buying steel from us.
All right, everyone, welcome back to the Benj and Sailor Show. Today we have my grandparents on with us, Charlie and Carol Compass. We're really excited to have them. One of the reasons why we're wanting to have them on the show with us is because these two have had a huge impact on my life and growing up, and I love them dearly. And they've helped Sailor and I a lot with our marriage, and we're grateful for them. And so just a little bit of background on them, and you guys correct me if I say anything wrong.
Yeah.
you guys both grew up in Southern California. What yes. town specifically in California?
Arcadia.
In Arcadia. It's probably a lot different then than it is now, huh?
Yes.
Is that a good yes or no, or a bad yes?
It's crowded now, and it was not when we were growing up.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. I bet it's crazy.
Yeah.
And so you guys grew up in Arcadia, went to high school, ended up going to college, and then you guys got married after college, correct?
That's correct.
You guys had three boys, one of them being my father, and then your dad owned a steel company.
No, a machine shop.
He owned a machine shop.
Yes. So what does that mean? Because I have no idea what that means.
What was it called again? I remember the name.
It was called Screw Products.
Yes, there you go.
Screw Products.
Screw Products, yeah. The name has always elicited some unique comments, but basically the machines were originally made to make bolts and nuts and screws.
Okay.
And that's why they were called screws. They were called Screw Products.
Screw Products.
Like screws. But we made a lot more significant or intricate things than just screws and nuts and bolts. We made parts for automotive industry, for the aircraft industry.
And so how did it transition into you when your dad worked there? He owned part of it, right?
He and his brother were equal partners.
Yes. And okay. How did it transition into you owning it?
I was never part of the ownership there. I was just part of the management there when, after I graduated from college, I worked for my dad and my uncle. But then my uncle died and my dad sold the company. And when my dad sold the company, then I had to go find a job.
So, okay. So what did you...
That's when I went out on my own and started a company with a friend of mine. We started a company importing steel from Japan.
Wow.
Machining steel. The same kind of machining type steel that we used in the machine shop.
Mm. So that's where you had that connection.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
It was a natural.
Do you remember what year it was you started?
It was 1971.
And you guys were married.
Yes. Yes.
Jeff
yes.
was just born.
Yes.
Yes.
And then you decided to start. So what was like the reason why you decided to go start a company rather than getting a job?
It was the happening between you and your partner, between Dick. And Dick said, hey, let's start a business. And you said, okay. Because
we were
going to go start working for the company that bought Screw Products.
Mm. I was, but then we got together and started talking, and both of us were out of a job, and we just put our heads together and said, hey, let's not go work for somebody else. Let's do it ourselves. We can do it.
So Dick worked at the same company that you were working
at? No. He actually worked for a steel supply company that supplied steel to my father's company. So I knew him for years and years
and
years.
Okay, so that's how he had the connections to the steel company
yes.
uh-huh. in Japan.
Yes.
He was quite a bit older.
Okay.
He was like 13 years older than we were.
How old were you guys at the time?
28.
Yeah.
28.
He had a lot of connections with Japanese steel companies because he'd been selling Japanese steel for a long time. And I didn't know anything about the business. But he said, I'll teach you. And I had been selling for my dad. I learned, I worked my way up through my dad's company and became a salesman. And actually, the third year that I was in sales for my dad, I was the top salesman.
Heck yeah.
Wow, incredible.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So how did you become the top salesman? Like, what resources were out there that helped you to become a better salesman, right? Today you have YouTube, you have, anyway, you can watch all these different videos online or read books. But back then, like, what did you do to become the best salesman?
It's very simple. It's all about numbers. I've heard Benjamin talk about this before. My sales manager told me when I first started, he said, when you want to be successful in sales, you just have to make a certain number of sales calls a day. And the way you do that is, you start every morning at 9 o'clock in the morning and you make sales calls until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And you do that
every day,
day after day after day. And if you make a certain number of sales calls, you'll find out how many sales calls will net you a purchase, somebody buying something from you. And so that's just, it's the numbers game. It's the old sales numbers game. And just kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And started getting more customers and more customers and more customers. And
yeah, and then eventually you became just like one of the top salesmen there. That's awesome.
And I stumbled onto a couple of customers that ended up being huge customers. It wasn't that I had so many customers, it's that some of the customers that I stumbled upon became huge customers.
Well, I
but
can
you
see.
You have to develop a relationship with your customer in order to be able to have their trust. And you do that and pretty soon they, yeah.
Wow, it sounds like a lot like Benj. You can see a lot of you in him or him in you. I don't know which way you'd say that, but he's talked a lot about that too. I mean, you started out in a sales job, so you know exactly what your grandpa's talking about. There's so many things that can come out of being such a great salesman and learning how to sell. Like, it applies to everything in your life. Seriously, every single part of your life.
And being persistent.
Yeah. And not giving up, especially when you know it's a good thing, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's, I'd say that's the hardest part about sales is you wake up every morning not knowing if you're going to sell anything. I mean, you could call as many people as you want, but even if you know your statistic of, okay, I got to make 100 calls to get one sale. Well, there could be days you make 300 calls and don't sell anything. You know, it could happen. Mm-hmm. And that was probably my biggest realization with when it came to sales and perseverance is actually being willing to persevere. Because people talk about it. They'll say, hey, just all you gotta do is just keep calling, but you actually have to keep calling rather than just talking about it,
yes,
of how many calls you need to make. I came to realize that as well with it, so.
A story just came to mind about one of the potential customers that we had in the steel business that my partner said, you'll never get him to buy any steel from you. And I said, how do you figure that? And he says, because he never bought any steel from me. We sold Japanese steel. And at the time, there was a sentiment in America where a lot of people were still uncomfortable about the idea of doing business with the Japanese because of the war. There was still a lot of that sentiment left over. Well, this particular fellow was a Buy American.
A what?
A Buy American. He would only buy American steel.
Okay. Wow.
So when my partner had approached him previously, years and years and years before, he just said he would never buy steel from Japan. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I told my partner, I'm going to go get that guy.
I'm sure he was like, whatever, you're wasting your time.
Yeah, he did. So what I did was I bugged him. And maybe that's not a good term to use.
You just reminded him that you were constantly there waiting for him to say yes.
I visited him like once a month religiously. And every time I would go visit him, he'd say, you know, I'm not going to buy any steel from you. And I said, yeah, I know, but maybe someday you will. Well, I'm never going to. And I said, well, that's okay. We can still get together and visit and talk. One day I was able to show up there at lunchtime and I said, hey, let's go get lunch. And he went, had lunch with me. And I thought, that's totally cool. So another time he said, I'm going to be traveling on vacation down to Newport Beach this weekend. And I said, oh yeah? He said, yeah, I'll be down in your neighborhood. And I said, well, why don't we get together and have dinner? And so he said, really? You want to get together and have dinner with me and my wife? And I said, sure. So do you remember meeting him?
I do.
Were they like an older couple than you guys? Like significantly
older?
Yeah,
I think they were significantly older. He was probably in his 50s.
And we were about
30. Yeah, I'm sure he was like, why does this young couple want to go out with us?
Yeah.
Like, it's different. Yeah. But different works. You got you eventually got it, I'm assuming. Yeah.
So anyway, we went to dinner and that helped solidify our relationship. But I still kept calling on him and calling on him. I know this story is getting longer and longer, but there's a point to the good point. So one day I knew that he used a particular material over and over and over. He had one job that required half-inch round steel. Now, all of our steel was in 12-foot lengths, bar stock. that feeds into a machine. So I told our driver one day, I said, put 1,000 pounds of half inch round on the truck and deliver it to this company. We'll call it XYZ company. He said, okay. And I said, what about the paperwork? And I said, don't put any paperwork with him. I said, put our tag on it, you know, our identification tag on the bundle of steel and deliver it there. So he did. And about a month later, I get a phone call. Not a month later, a couple of weeks later, I get a phone call from the owner of the company. He says, what's the idea? I said, what do you mean, what's the idea? He said, you sent me a bunch of steel up here and I didn't order it. And I said, well, did you already use it? And he said, yeah. He said, am I supposed to pay for it? And I said, no, it was a gift. And he said, well, so what's the deal? And I said, well, I want you to ask your machinist if the steel wasn't high quality and didn't give you better tool life and a better finish. And he said, I've already asked him that. And he said, it did.
Yeah.
So I said, so what now? And he said, well, I guess you're going to try to sell me some steel. And I said, yeah, I am.
Heck yeah, you got it. That reminds me, one of our really good friends, he owns like quite a bit of units. And when he was starting out, he really wanted this one apartment complex. And there was a lot of bidders going for this one apartment complex. And so when you are signifying when the owner is signifying to one of the bidders that they want to do whatever they offered them, right? You put a certain amount down called earnest money, and that money is non-refundable. And it's just saying, hey, I'm basically paying for your time that we're going to go through due diligence. We're going to see the property, but here's just some money so you know I'm serious, right? So he's like, he calls up one of his friends who owns even more units than he does. And he's like, I really, really want this unit deal. What do I do? And he said, give him this amount of money. Just send him a check right now. So he gives him a check. Same thing, kind of what you did, puts it all out there. That person could say, no, like I'm keeping all your money, but I'm not going with you, right? They could have done that, but because he put forth the effort, they're like, the next day, called him up. Okay, let's do this deal. And he got that apartment complex.
Do you remember how much money it was?
I don't remember.
It was like at least half a million dollars.
Yeah, I'll have to clarify that later.
No.
Yeah. But when you're serious about something and you show someone how much you want something that they have and you know how much you're willing to do business with them and take good care of them, they'll take good care of you.
And as you go through life, and you do things like that, it comes around. There are things that you do and it will come around. It's like an echo through life.
Yeah, like what you said, if you wanna like have a happy life, you gotta do good.
And yes,
it just comes back.
There's a little bit more to that story. He finally relented and said, okay, he said, you know what? He said, maybe you got something about this Japanese steel. First of all, Japanese steel was far superior to American steel at the time because American steel was still being produced by furnaces, by blast furnaces and steel plants that were constructed at the early 1900s. And Japanese steel mills were all bombed out during the war, and they were all brand new, When the Americans went back over there and helped with the reconstruction of Japan after we bombed everything.
They got better factories.
Yeah, they got better factories. They made better steel. So anyway, he started buying steel from us. Then he'd buy a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here. And my partner was just flabbergasted.
Yeah. He probably was like, really, this time he listens? But hey, it was you. You did
it
work.
How did you ever do that? So anyway, he said, you know, he buys a lot more steel. And I said, yeah, I know he does. He got like 45 machines. So I went to him one day and I said, how would you like to save some money on your steel purchases? And he says, what do you got in mind? And I said, I'll tell you what. If you'll buy every pound of steel from us, I'll give you a 10% discount on everything you buy from us. He said, well, I'll have to think about that. Well, he didn't think about it too long.
Yeah, he figured out the numbers and was like, holy cow, I better say yes before it takes
it back. He started buying all of his steel from us, and we sold him. We sent a truckload of steel there at least once or twice a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
And back then, what were the prices you were selling it for?
I do remember.
You know, that was what, 50 years ago?
Maybe 25 cents a pound for carbon steel, free machining steel.
And what is it now? Cents,
I don't know, it's probably a dollar.
Oh, I'm sure it's more. I bet it's more.
It's more than that.
We'll go check after this.
Yeah.
Everything was sold by the pound. But.
How long were you in that position where you just sold steel? Like, did you go?
You know, I need to go make you go back a little bit.
Okay.
When Charlie and I were first married, his father, we were going to work in his business. Mm-hmm. We were going to take it over maybe someday.
Okay.
So we had our future planned out. But his father sold that business. And we looked at each other and said, oh, what are we going to do now?
Yeah, that's not our future anymore. There it went.
Anymore. There it went right out from underneath of us.
What did your dad do?
He was in construction of his life. He was a builder. And so that's when he started looking around of what we could do. And actually, that's when he met Dick.
Actually, I didn't look around very much because just one day it just happened to just the two of us ran into each other and we got our heads together and, hey, let's go do this. We can do this.
But that's another thing that happens in
life.
Each
one of us put $3,000. Now, this is what was really crazy. We didn't have a lot of money at the time. We put $3,000 together, each one of us, and that's what we incorporated with, $3,000. And 6 years later, I sold my interest to that company.
What percentage of the company did you own with Dick?
Half, 50%.
50-50.
Yes, 50-50.
Wow. Okay.
So you sold your interest. You worked there you ran it with Dick for 6 years. So what was it like, you know, management-wise? Obviously, you talked about you going out and getting contracts, right? But how did you guys kind of manage it?
There's no question that Dick was the brains of the business. He knew the business. He'd been in the business before, and I was just brand new. But I learned quick, and I had a pretty good background from business education in school where I graduated from college, and I picked up on it fast. I pretty much, in today's terms, would have been the COO. I ran the company.
Okay.
He
liked to play golf.
He liked to play golf.
He was the network guy, right?
He was the golf guy.
But there's no question, I have to give him credit. He was the brains of the business. I just made sure that the steel came in and the steel came out and the trucks ran and the employees were happy. And so I took care of the books and made sure that we were making money.
Yeah, so you're basically in charge of scaling it. How many employees do you think you had when you left?
We had probably 15.
15 employees.
You don't need very many employees to run a really big money business selling steel. It's kind of like, if I could relate it to the lumber business. You know, you go to the lumber yard and you buy a bunch of 2x4s and you load them on a truck and you deliver them out to the construction site. That's what we did.
Okay.
We loaded steel on a truck and took it to the machine shops and delivered it. And there wasn't a whole lot more sophisticated part of the business other than unloading the truck when we got the material in, put it in the warehouse, put it back on a truck, sell it
and
to
a
machinist.
Wow.
It was a very simple business, very simple.
Yeah. So for you, when did you start thinking that, hey, this isn't what I want to be doing anymore. I'm going to leave.
That's a good one.
Carol, he's looking at you.
Well, we had our children by then. Our
boys
had been born and they were growing up. And we lived in a neighborhood that had a lot of children. And the way that we looked at what was going on around us just was not something that we wanted. It got more and more crowded. We were living in San Juan Capistrano, and it was beautiful. It was a wonderful life. He was making more money than I could spend.
Oh, well, that's awesome. I'm sure a lot of women would be very happy with that.
But we weren't happy.
Yeah.
And that was a number one priority for us. We just said, you know, there's got to be something more in life than what we're doing. And so he started looking on Sunday afternoons. He'd start looking in the newspaper about land for sale.
We weren't unhappy.
No, but we weren't.
We knew there was,
you know, there's something missing.
Something missing.
Something a little bit off.
Yes. So we had a motorhome. And we went on a trip. We took the kids and we drove through southern Utah and drove through Kanab. And there was a big sign that said land for sale. And Charlie, we stopped and he said, you feed the kids lunch. I'm going to go talk to this guy. And it was Lynn Goodfellow.
Oh, yeah. And this guy's really famous in the Compass family.
He was, yes. And so we spent the afternoon with him. And he took us up to his house and we got to meet his family and his wife. And it was just, it was wonderful. And when we left that afternoon, I looked at him and I said, whatever it is, They've got it, and that's what I want. I want our family to have that kind of life. So we went home to San Juan, and a week later, Lynn Goodfellow called and he said, "Are you really serious about land?" And Charlie said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay, the ranch next to me is for sale, and I have the first option to buy it. Do you want to come back up here and look at it?" And we said, "Sure." So he sent his airplane, a little teeny airplane was like four passengers, and he picked us up in San Juan and drove through the Grand Canyon, flew through the Grand Canyon.
Beautiful.
And this was Lynn.
Yes.
Picked you up in his plane.
Yes.
Wow, that's so awesome.
It was really neat. And he took us home to his home in Kanab. He had a runway that was in front of his house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we got out and we traipsed all over that property. It was 500 acres. And there was nothing except for sagebrush and dirt.
A lot of good sagebrush.
Yeah. And we ended up...
You've probably seen sagebrush that's like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The sagebrush there was like as tall as the...
Oh my gosh, it had never ever gotten like caught fire or anything.
No. Mm-mm.
I know it was that tall because I chopped it.
Yeah. Oh boy, that
so
was
So we bought that ranch.
So we bought it.
Wow.
So
without
did you
even...
buy it before you sold?
Yes. No.
Yes, remember we had rented our house in San Juan.
Oh yes, we did.
Yeah.
Yes, we did.
How much was the piece of property? Do you remember?
500 acres.
The 500 acres, I think it was around 200,000 or something like that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Our first house was 10,000 square foot lot.
Yeah.
$400,000.
Yeah, something like that.
Now, you might ask, well, why did we decide to buy? Why was I so interested in some land? For some reason or another, I'd always had an itch for owning some land somewhere. In fact, the house that we had in San Juan was 2.5 acres. And we were really happy there. We thought we were. We weren't unhappy. But our accountant that did our accounting for our steel company, mm-hmm. he would come down every quarter and do a quarterly statement. And numerous times he would say to my partner and I, "You guys are giving way too much money to the Internal Revenue Service for taxes. And there's a way you can keep a lot of that money that's legal." Mm-hmm. And through write-offs and so forth. And so I said, "Well, okay, so what do you suggest?" And he gave us some suggestions. And one of them was buy a piece of land somewhere, buy an old farm. And that just clicked. I said, "Oh boy, that sounds like..."
Yeah, that sounds like my kind of stuff.
I've been thinking about that.
Yeah.
So that's another link in the chain that brought us to buying this piece of property.
Well, and also that piece of property, I drove by it with Benj probably about like a month ago. I mean, it's like Kanab's out in the middle of nowhere. Like, you're not talking about like somewhere like, yeah, like a little bit outside of a city with some farmland. You're talking about like it's in the middle of nowhere.
And we were 10 miles out of Kanab.
Out of Kanab, yeah.
Yeah, that's...
But it was on the way to Lake Powell.
Yep, right yeah. under the lake.
An hour.
Anyway, so we originally were thinking about buying that property and just owning as an investment. But when the boys heard about it, they said, "Let's go and live there."
Jeff was 11.
Okay.
Andy was 9, and David was 7.
Oh, that's like the boys' dream.
Perfect.
Yes.
Perfect.
So,
motorcycles.
So if we're going to go live there, we got to do something about selling all this stuff. So I went in and talked to my business partner and told him one morning, I said, "Let's go down to the coffee shop and have breakfast." He said, "Okay." We went down there and I said, "I want to sell my share of the business." And he said, "What?" And I said, it just was totally out of the blue.
Yeah.
I want to sell my share of the business. You want to buy it? And he said, "Yeah, of course." And he says, "Have you got any idea about money? What you want to sell it for?" And I said, "Yeah." We took out a napkin, a paper napkin mm-hmm. at the coffee shop and wrote a contract on the napkin.
Really? Just sign it? Like everything, like this is a full-on contract or is this just like...
No, it was crazy. Anyway, I don't think I've got that napkin anymore. I think I had it for a while. But anyway, the napkin was all of the numbers.
Okay.
It's the only thing we had to write on. All the numbers. And he said, "Well, if those numbers are all correct, you got a deal." And I said, "Okay." We shook hands and he said, "Go down to the accountant and tell the accountant, take the napkin down there to the accountant. And then after you visit the accountant, go see the lawyer and tell everybody to get their heads together and start drawing up contracts. And that was the end of it. And we sold it and packed up and went to Utah.
So did you get all the money out straight front, or did you have to finance a little bit?
That's
the next shoe that dropped. And that's probably one of the reasons why Carol and I ended up being school teachers. A couple of years went by, and we got a down payment from the sale of the business, and then monthly payments.
Okay.
And then one day, we got that fateful telephone call from my partner, and he says, I'm going bankrupt. And I said, why? What happened? Well, it's a long, long story, but I'll tell you a couple of the factors. He overextended himself. He tried to expand faster than he probably should have. And there was some difficulty with supply chain from Japan. And there was some difficulty at that time economically with the fluctuation of the dollar versus the yen, the Japanese yen. And it was just like the perfect storm. And he lost it.
And remember, he didn't have him to be with him, and he liked to play golf.
Yeah, so the COO had left.
Thanks, Carol. Yes.
And now everything just kind of came together.
Yes.
Because I left, right?
Yes.
So do you
that's
feel...
what she's always thought.
Okay, so that's your thinking. Do you think the same thing?
Or... No, I think he just, he overextended himself, and he was a good businessman. I think they just, some things internally and externally that all came together, and it just made it so he had to walk away from it.
Yeah.
So then,
which was sad.
What do you do next?
One other thing I have to mention was his little daughter got killed in a serious automobile accident.
Yes.
And they used up all the insurance money, and their poor family, I think that might have been the nail on the coffin.
Oh, so I'm sure that was, yes. I mean, having such a tragic accident happened.
They lost a lot of money in that, trying to save her life.
Well, and not only that, too, is, I mean, you have your time and just, like, your energy and your emotions all into that. It's really hard to run a successful business and be fighting something like that.
Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is, what do we do now?
Yeah.
So we had a little family council, and I said, well, I've still got all my nice suits. I can get my suits out of the closet. I could go back to L.A. and sell steel. I could have gone to work for any of the steel companies in L.A. in a heartbeat.
So pause real quick. When you sold it, right, you guys moved to Kanab, started living there, you built a house, right? How long after you sold did he call you and tell you that?
It was about 2 years.
So what were you doing during that two-year span?
During
were you guys retired?
Yes.
We were. And we thought that we would be able to sustain our lives with the ranch, but we weren't. Two things happened that made it so we weren't able to sustain the ranch. One, we found out that we couldn't water any more than about 60 acres. We had 500 acres, and we didn't have enough irrigation right to be able to irrigate the whole 500 acres. We didn't find this out ahead of time, which was a mistake on our part. But when we found that out, now we've got a problem because we cannot do what we thought we could do with this 500 acres. So
onward. Next. So what do we do?
The second thing was the fact that we had started building our house.
On that piece
of property. And we were using the money that we were receiving to build the house. We were not debt-free because we were still paying for the ranch. So now we had no income coming. We're building a house. We owe on the ranch.
We were only 35 years old.
And what do we do? So?
I said, I'll go to work. So we said, let's go over to Cedar City and go back to school. And while I signed up to go back to school, he got to talking with the dean of business. Was that what he was?
Yeah. We were over at SUU, Southern Utah University. She had to meet with her counselor over there and get enrolled and all of that.
And I could do it in a year and a half.
And I was just cruising around the campus checking it out, thinking about, well, what's our next step here? We're going to have to live over here. Maybe I better go find a place to live. But in the meantime, I was just cruising around campus checking it out, and I sat down on this bench. And this guy came walking by, and he said, hi, how's it going? And I said, fine, how are you? He sticks out his hand, and he says, hi, my name is Harold Hiskey. I'm the dean of the business school here. And I said, really? He said, yeah. What are you doing here? He said. And I said, well, my wife's over at the education building getting enrolled to get a teaching certificate so that she can teach school. He says, what do you mean? Where do you live? And I said, well, we live over in Kanab. We started asking all these questions, and over a period of a little bit of time, we're sitting there talking. He says, I want to talk to you. Come up to my office. So I said, okay. He said, you got some time, don't you? And I said, okay. So while we're walking up to his office, I said, what do you want to talk to me about?
Yeah, what am I in trouble for? It's like the principal's office, right?
He said, so you've retired from business in Southern California, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, and so you own a ranch over in Kanab now, right? Yeah. And he said, so you tell me you graduated from USC from the business school, right? And I said, yeah. He said, well, how'd you like to come to work for me? Hmm. And I said, what do you mean? He says, that as an adjunct business professor. And I said, that would kind of make us change directions on a lot of things, because my wife wants to go back to Kanab to teach elementary school, and I want to go back to Kanab to finish the ranch. And he said, well, you can teach for a little while. And I said, no, I don't think that's going to work. And he says, well, all right, then why don't you teach? I said, what do you mean? We're already talking about teaching. He says, I mean, when you go back over to Kanab. I said, well, how do I do that? And he says, enroll in the business school here and go to school here and get your certificate, and you could be a teacher, and you and your wife can both go over and teach. So I said, gee, that sounds like a good idea. So when Carol got done with her enrollment and everything like that, we met back up, went and had lunch, and she said, what have you been doing? I said, well, I've been enrolling in the business school.
Oh my, she's like, I left you alone for an hour? What happened?
You didn't have cell phones to text back and forth.
No,
hey, baby,
no,
I'm enrolling in the school. Yeah. It was like, hey, what have you been up to for the last hour?
But it is interesting how things in life just go together.
Yeah.
So we packed up our kids, and we found a little house to rent over in Cedar City, and we moved over there and spent a year and a half going to school there, and got our teaching certificates, and we ended up going back to Kanab. And Carol got a job right away in the elementary school. I wasn't able to get a job right away because there wasn't a vacancy, but a year later there was. Mm-hmm. And I got a job teaching business and marketing in the high school and in the community college there. They had a little community college that was a satellite community college there. And I taught night classes for the community college. And Carol taught at the elementary school.
Lived there for 18 years.
In Kanab. So I have a question. So you guys still had all the your debts to pay in Kanab, and you guys moved to Cedar City and had to rent a house, and you also had to pay for food, and you had three boys.
How did we ever do it?
Yeah, what did you, I mean,
we
what
did.
Happened?
We sold everything we had.
Yeah. Did you sell Kanab?
No, we sold everything that was a liquid asset. If we had
borrowed.
Stock, we sold all of our stock.
We borrowed on our insurance.
Yeah, we borrowed. In our insurance policies.
Yeah,
we sold our motorhome.
Yeah. First of all, we lived in it for a while.
Yeah. Oh, three boys?
Yes.
Oh,
good night, Jeff. Good night, Eddie.
Yeah. I can't imagine that. That'd be crazy. Yeah. Okay.
Well, it was a good part of our life.
How did you guys handle the stress? Were you guys stressed, or were you just always like, we can do this?
I don't ever remember being stressed.
I don't either.
We laughed about things. Things had happened bad, and all we did, we'd say, oh, well, that was just an attack.
Oh, okay.
Because we felt like we were pioneers, you know, out on this ranch.
Yeah. It's
with sagebrush. But we somehow we made it through. We never gave up. We were persistent, and we just, okay, this is what's the next thing that we have to do.
We built a lovely home. We pretty much built it all ourselves. What we had to hire out, we did hire out.
Mm-hmm.
But
I even roofed.
You did?
I sat on the top of the roof.
Yeah.
She sat on the top of the roof and threw shingles down to me.
Oh, perfect.
I did all of the plumbing. I couldn't do the wiring or the drywalling. I don't do that. But the framing, the carpenter and I did all the framing. And
the boys helped.
I did all the cabinets. Oh, here's a good story. I hired a guy to do the cabinets. Mm-hmm. And the day before he was going to start, he fell and broke his hip.
Perfect.
So I said, Charlie and Carol, I can't build your cabinets for you. I said, well, this is a bad deal.
Yeah.
And I thought about it for a while, and I said, you know what? I'm pretty good with wood. So I went into his house. His name was Lowell Johnson. And I said, Lowell, he was in a wheelchair. He says, I'm going to be in this wheelchair for like 6 weeks. And I said, how about you show me how to build cabinets? And we go out in your shop, and you tell me how to build cabinets, and we build cabinets. He had already bought all the material. He had it in his shop. I said, Lowell, I can't wait 6 weeks till you get well. Let's go do it right now. So he said, okay. So every morning I'd drive into town, and he'd
sit in his chair and tell you what to do.
Wow. Seems like you guys, you were very persistent. I mean, you had
adaptable.
Yeah, very adaptable, right? Like you were gonna, you were told earlier when you talked about your selling that the Japanese steel to that one guy. He's never gonna buy it. Okay, well, what if I take him out to lunch? What if I meet with him? What if I send it over and he tries it out, right? And then same thing here, like I need those cabinets done. Okay, how can I get this done? I'm gonna build them, he can watch me. He'll tell me what to do.
Yeah.
That, just that mindset right there, I really do feel like that's what created a lot of opportunities for you guys and really propelled you forward.
Yes.
Well, and I can tell you what too, they've had that mindset ever since I've known them. Yeah. All that I can remember, like going back to my childhood, whenever I'd come and visit you guys, we'd always do something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We'd build something or we'd put something together. And the home you guys live in now, you remodeled the whole thing yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what, five, six,
seven years
ago, and you guys did
Oh my gosh,
work.
Really?
Yes.
With Sailor, when I would go over to their house, I'd stay with them for like a week.
Uh-huh.
And we'd get up early in the morning, have breakfast, and then we'd go out and we'd work all day.
We come in for lunch.
Mm. We just go work out in the pasture, you know, moving sprinklers and that was like only 10 years ago.
Not long ago.
The house that what Benjamin is talking about is the house that we bought up in Hobble Creek Canyon. We bought 38. After we sold our ranch, we moved up to Hobble Creek Canyon and bought 30 acres up there, a little bit smaller cattle ranch.
We leased the pastures for cows.
But
we had to take care
of the cows, and we had to water the fields, and we had to move the sprinkler pipe every day, and Benjamin would come and stay. And Benjamin and I have the record of moving the sprinkler pipe the fastest of anybody.
Really? You timed it?
We ran. Yes. We actually timed it. We ran.
Oh my gosh. How old were you when you did that?
He was probably 14, maybe.
Yeah, 13. I mean, it was 10 years ago. I mean, how old are you guys now? 70?
80.
You guys are 80?
We're on our way to 81.
Oh,
we'll be 81 in May.
So you were 70. You were 70, and we were running around those fields.
Yeah, and you were 14.
Running around and wearing irrigation boots, running the sprinklers, dropping them over the fence, not scraping your arm on the barbed wire coming back up.
Or tripping. I mean, you trip and you're gone.
Do you remember how fast we moved him?
I think it was 28 minutes. Was it 28 minutes?
Yeah, it was.
28 minutes.
Yeah, wow.
Well,
that was another project. That Hubble Creek home was a real project, because when we bought that was not much more than just sagebrush. But to go back to the Kanab place, this is really something that I'm proud of. We not only built a house there, but we built roads. There were no roads. We actually built the roads with a Caterpillar tractor and a road grader.
And brought electricity up to the house.
And our next door neighbor, Lynn Goodfellow, had all of this equipment and taught me how to run it. So I am actually a D8 cat operator and a road grader.
Wow, I didn't know I was in the presence of someone.
I could actually right now probably go get a job in a construction site and operate heavy equipment.
Oh.
And we put in, like she said, we put in our own electrical line, our own phone line, our own water lines. We drilled 3 wells. We put in over 5 miles of fences.
All with good.
Built a barn and a corral.
Miles. Yeah.
And that place was just absolutely beautiful. We mowed all that 8-foot sagebrush down and planted a little crop called crested wheat. And we ended up with cows, and they grazed there. They grazed there during the winter.
It was a wonderful life.
In the summer, we would take them up to some summer pasture, 2,000 acres up, a little bit higher elevation, and graze them up there. But then we had a problem.
Yep.
All 3 of our sons left and didn't want to come back. To get old Kanab. So that's when we moved up to Hubble Creek Canyon and lived there.
Because they started having our grandchildren.
Yeah. You're like, hey, I want them. Come on.
Hey, I want them.
Yeah.
Taught every one of our grandchildren how to work.
Yeah, they all knew.
Well, I have a question.
Every
for
one
you
of them are good workers too.
Oh yeah, Dave. I can only speak for Dave, but he works really hard.
Yeah.
So for you guys, I know that you guys have given or have you guys bought apartment complexes and gave them to each of your kids, each of your 3 sons. Mm-hmm. How did you get enough capital to do that as school teachers?
When my father died, he left us some money.
Okay.
He left us $90,000. And we took that $90,000 and bought, believe it or not, with $90,000, we bought 3 fourplexes in Orem, Utah.
OK.
cash?
No. We paid $30,000 down on each one and took a mortgage on each one and started renting out these properties. And eventually, real estate increased and rents increased.
Yes. Right, we were right and, during that time.
And so we just decided that each one of our children needed to have something, so we gave each one of them one of those units. We gave your father one of the units, we gave Andy one of the units, and Jeff one of the units.
And they all lived in them, too, and
at one time,
managed them.
Yeah, your mom and dad lived in one of them, Andy and Sarah lived
there
in one of them, Jeff
plexus.
And Jenny lived in, we even lived in one of them for a time.
Yeah.
And then your mom and dad took one of the units that we gave your mom and dad and sold it to Jeff.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they took the money that they sold it from, and they bought two units of their own in Pleasant Grove. And then Andy sold one of his units to Jeff, so Jeff owns now three. And he took the money he got from the sale of his unit and bought three units down in Spanish Fork.
Sounds like Monopoly, so the, like a little Monopoly family, game.
Yeah. The whole family was involved in multi-family residential income property.
And all of us worked on those apartments too. Yeah. I remember painting and cleaning and ripping up carpet. It was,
we at one time, the four families, your dad and your uncles and grandma and I, we actually owned and maintained and managed 56 units, 56 rental units in the Utah Valley.
That's awesome. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But all of those are sold now.
Yeah.
And where we have taken our money that we've sold our ranch and our property in Hubble Creek, now we have invested in more rental property. We're back in the rental property again. We built three fourplexes in Rexburg, Idaho. And that business has been a great side hustle for us.
Yeah.
If any of you 80-year-olds want a side hustle, here we go from you guys. Get yourself some apartment units in Rexburg,
it's
Idaho.
It's not easy.
Oh, I can imagine that it was easy at all.
Yeah.
But you guys persevered. Mm-hmm. And you guys are really smart with your money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're missing a big part of the story that kind of brings our family to kind of the center of our lives now. And that's when you guys were converted to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I love this story. I don't know if Sailor's heard it yet, but we'd like to just kind of hop in that a little bit. So I know it was the Good Fellows. They were already members. They kind of helped you guys. Where did it start?
When we were looking around, when we were living in San Juan Capistrano, and we looked around and there was something missing in our life.
Yes, yeah, you guys said that.
Well, I know that it was the Lord. And he just took us in his hands and took us to Utah. And the Good Fellows were a big part of, they invited us to dinner the first night that we were there. And the missionaries were there, the sister missionaries. And for the next month, we learned about the gospel. And Charlie and Jeff and Andy were baptized. I didn't need to be baptized because I was born in the church. My mother and father were raised in the church.
So you were already baptized?
I was already baptized.
Do you remember that?
I do. I do remember. But my parents fell away, and so I didn't ever know the church when I was young. Okay. Where did we go from there?
Were you guys believers in Christ? Did you guys like do anything at home before then? Or was it like, no, strictly work and just live your life?
Yep. There were times when I think that we thought about it. I wished we would have joined the church earlier in our life, but it just wasn't meant to be. So when we moved to Kanab, that's when we joined the church.
My father was born and raised Catholic. My mother was born and raised in some little church in the middle of nowhere in Illinois. You know, some little farm preacher or something like that. But when she married my dad, they decided not to raise my brother and I and my sister in the Catholic Church, but they raised us in an Episcopal church, which is similar to Catholicism, but not the same. So I had a little bit of a religious upbringing, and my father taught me how to pray, and he always came into my bedroom when he was home, and we prayed together. So prayer was not a foreign thing to me, and I'm sure it wasn't a foreign thing to...
I didn't know anything about prayer.
Well,
but in my heart, I always knew that there was a God, And I knew that I had come, I had been before this life.
You were something before you came to,
yes,
to Earth, and you were,
yes,
here.
Yes. And I know that I'm going to go on.
I had an interesting thing that happened that I can remember, even though I was a really small child. I asked my mother one time, "Who am I?" And she looked at me like, "Well, what's wrong with you?" And I said, and she says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, where did I come from?" And she says, "Well, you came from me. I'm your mother." And I said, "Yeah, but I mean, where did I come before from that, before that?"
Isn't that interesting?
You always had a burning desire to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I couldn't have been more than 5 or 6 years old at the time. And, I could imagine my mother would have thought, there's something wrong with this kid.
Well, I bet she thought, that's a really good question.
I
probably should take some thought into that, you know?
They never joined the church, and my mother and father never came back either. But my mother and father, my mother cried every time she talked to me after we joined the church. And I think it was because she knew we had done good, that we had done right.
Yeah, that you'd found God again.
Yes.
The influence of the church was obviously with you, because you were born in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But I had some connection with it because I knew you. And one day your mother said something about the Joseph Smith story. And I said, "Well, what's the Joseph Smith story?" And she said, "Well, he saw this angel, and this angel gave him these gold plates." And I kind of scoffed and said, "Yeah, right." But I also had some connection with Mormons before that. When I was working for my father in the machine shop, after college I started working in the various departments to learn the business.
Yeah.
And I worked under a guy whose name was Alma Farnworth. First name Alma. And I said, "Alma, that's a funny name. Where'd you get a name like that?" And he says, "Well, it's a Book of Mormon name." And I said, "A Book of Mormon name? Are you Mormon?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Oh." So one day I was talking to my dad and I said, "Dad, did you know that Al Farnsworth's name is really Alma?" Because he always signed the checks and everything, Al. And I said, "Did you know that he's a Mormon?" He says, "Yeah, I knew he's a Mormon." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "If you ever have your own business and you want somebody to take care of your business and watch your finances,
you ought to hire a Mormon."
Yeah.
Because they're so honest.
You know who we learned that from? Howard Hughes.
Oh.
Howard Hughes was one of the richest men in the world
and
at the time.
And he also said that.
And he had Mormons running his business.
Was he in airplanes? Or?
Yep.
Yeah. There's a movie about him that I watched. Yes. I think Leonardo DiCaprio plays him. It's a good movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So my dad knew, I don't think he knew Howard Hughes personally, but he did a lot of business with the Hughes aircraft company because of our machine shop. Interestingly enough, when I was looking for somebody to kind of be like a manager in our business, our steel business, wouldn't you know it, one of the guys that applied was a Mormon, and I hired him, and he was great. He was a great, great manager, kind of a mid-level manager for us.
So what do you feel like when you guys decided to start going to church again, what do you feel like was one of the biggest teachings that impacted you and your family, that you started to believe or started to teach your sons?
Everything the young women, those missionary sisters, taught us, I had heard before. And I don't know where I'd heard it, because I didn't ever go to church when I was young. But I had heard all of their teaching before, and I knew it was all true. I knew that I was a child of God. I knew that He was there, and I trusted Him to guide us in our life, all the way through our lives. I think that's helped, that we have been grateful, and we've been trusting, and we jumped ahead. That was one of my favorite sayings to my sons. Every time they had a big decision to make, jump ahead. And if you think about that, you don't just walk ahead, you jump. You are jumping now.
For me, it was the Joseph Smith story. We have to accept everything about God and Jesus Christ in faith. But when you hold a copy of the Book of Mormon in your hand, that's hard evidence. You have to read it and believe it, that it's the Word of God on faith. But nonetheless, to me, it was hard evidence. I was convinced to join the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints out here long before I was convinced down there or converted, because it all made total sense. I mean, there's so much, faith is important, but there's so much in the word of reason that anybody that's a reasonable person can take facts and understand facts as reality. And the fact is, the Book of Mormon is not something that some uneducated person just decided to pencil down. I mean, it's real.
And you guys felt that after reading it, I'm sure. Mm-hmm.
And we've read it ever since. Every single night we read in the Book of Mormon.
Never miss a day.
Night.
And you guys had no idea the impact it would have on your posterity.
Yes.
You know, like I can say, like for me personally, I know that I never would have met my wife without your guys' decision.
Isn't it amazing? All of our sons went on missions. They were married in the temple. And our grandchildren, we had 14 grandchildren, and 7 of them have gone on missions, or a lot more.
Oh, let's see. Three from this family.
Just imagine the...
One and the three. Yeah, 7.
7.
Good company.
Yes. Hey, I'll speak for Carol right here. We can remember everything. Yes. For the most part.
Yeah. Well, it's been a very, very wonderful life. We've had the hardships, but we've gotten through them. We've had wonderful things that have happened. And the joy, you just can't find it anywhere else outside of family.
Yeah.
There is a certain joy that comes from being in families.
I mean, that's what you saw when you went over to the Goodfellows that one
exactly.
time. You saw their family and you're like, I want
that's
something
I want.
Like that. I want peace with my family.
Yes.
And that's something that the gospel can bring to every single one.
Exactly.
And what I love about your story is you were at a point when you talked about earlier where you did... You couldn't spend as much money as you guys were earning, right? And a lot of people right now in their life are trying to go for that. That is their goal, is to have financial freedom. But you got to remember at the end of the day that if you don't have God, if you don't have Jesus Christ, if you don't have the gospel, you're going to get there and then you're still not going to have everything. But if you do have that gospel, you can be happy at every single point in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we talked about earlier, even before starting this podcast, was happiness is where you find it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to choose to find that happiness.
Right. Exactly.
And that's what the gospel brings. It brings a lot of peace to your life. And I think one of the things for us as we are going on this new adventure is we know that at the end of the day, if we're going to be together forever and we're going to be with Emerald forever, and if anything bad happens, like nothing... really bad could happen to us.
Right.
Like death, the Savior conquered death.
Yes.
We're going to conquer death because of the Savior. And if the only bad thing in our life that can happen can't happen, which is us being separated like that, then we're going to be okay.
Yeah, exactly. You just keep going and trust that God can help you get through. And if you stay close to the gospel, you will. You'll be able to handle anything that comes. Life is just a journey that has a lot of bumps.
It's a roller coaster.
Yes, it's a roller coaster. And if you can get through those hard times, it will make you stronger.
I'd have to say our greatest successes in our lives have been our marriage, our family, our religion, our country, our patriotism. Those are the things that make us happy, successes. Which leads me to a little segue.
Yes. I think we should add some music.
It's keeping him busy now.
Yeah.
Well, and one more thing before we jump into the awesome part, right?
Uh-huh.
I just want to bring this up. One thing I loved growing up was I knew that whenever I was with you guys, everything was going to be tied back to, you know, the most important part of life, and that is being with your family. Growing with your family, strengthening your relationship with God and Jesus Christ, right? And with your friends and with the people that matter most to you. And And every time we had a family reunion or some sort of family get together, we would always get together and we would have a spiritual thought and we would pray. And Grandpa would always pray. And for me, it's I've loved that example, knowing that, you know, you're a definition of the kind of man that I want to be.
Thank you.
That's good.
Because I know that when you're with your family and you gather and you talk about Christ, then it brings everyone closer. That's what he does.
That's right.
I'm sorry, I don't usually ever cry, like ever.
It's, I know, usually I'm the one that cries.
It's you inherit.
It's okay. Do you know what we've decided what crying is?
Yeah.
It's uncontrollable gratitude.
It is. It's
gratitude.
Just gratitude coming out.
Uncontrollable.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. Heck, I can cry over a good cheeseburger.
Oh, I'm sure.
So what have you been doing lately?
Now, Grandpa, what?
What have I been doing lately? I've been writing a book.
Ooh.
Writing a book.
What's the book called?
It's called How to Be Successful at Anything. Just have a copy of it right here.
Let's pull it out for our viewers.
So I'm sure you go in there and kind of describe it, but how do you become successful at anything? Oh, I see you have a formula. How to be successful at anything.
Now read it. Read it exactly. How to be successful at anything.
Start with the basics.
Wait a second.
What is that?
There's a little star right there.
Oh. Asterisk.
Is that an asterisk?
Yeah.
Okay.
How to be successful at anything, asterisk.
Which is S.
What?
Asterisk. No.
What does that mean?
Asterisk.
Oh, I'm not going to tell you. That's in the book. You'll have to read
it. Oh, okay.
Okay.
But basically, you just have to start with the basics. That's what this book is all about. There's nothing sophisticated in this book about how to be successful. There's not 100 steps. There's not...
accomplish these 5 things.
Yeah, there's nothing like that. There's not programs or plans or steps or anything like that. It's just...
Or an online course.
It's just 3 basic things that will help you be...
Wait a second.
You don't want to tell them.
Oh, you don't?
No, you don't say that.
Okay.
You got to read the book to find
out
that.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
You got to read the book to find
You're
out
leaving
what
leaving us on a cliffhanger.
What the formula is.
What the formula is. H plus O plus W leads to success at anything, asterisk.
Oh, but you got to tell them what that.
What the basics are?
Yeah, what are the basics?
You have to read the book.
So when will that be published? When will that get out?
I'm very close to getting it published. This right here happens to be the 3rd draft. I'm working on the 4th draft right now. I'll have it to the editor probably in a month. Hopefully to have it in print
by next
summer,
Christmas.
Midsummer. And I have an email now. If you want, you could email me at the How Basics. THEHOWBASICH, thehowbasics@gmail.com. And if you write me at that email address, I will send you a link to a website and you can order the book. The book will be probably around 1995, and it teaches you how to be successful at anything.
Did you come up with the title before you started writing it? Or?
No, I didn't.
So you just started writing and then you're like, oh, this all ties in well. I guess my main question is, how did you come up with that? Why did you decide to write a book and why did you decide to write on that?
Well, it goes back to when I was teaching school. I guess I'm going to have to divulge what the H and the O and the W stands for.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, he didn't want to do that.
I know.
You don't have to.
When I was teaching school, my students knew that I had been a businessman before. And every now and then they would ask me, how were you so successful? I mean, just because we owned this big old ranch, everybody thought that I was very successful because I owned a big ranch. You know, we lived in a little ranching town, and if you owned a 500-acre ranch, you were big stuff. Even though at the time we were experiencing some financial issues because of the catastrophe with the sale of our company. But one day this student asked me, so why were you so successful? And I thought, oh, shoot, I better give him something. And I didn't have anything really to give him. I didn't have any. And I thought, maybe if I gave them anything sophisticated, they wouldn't understand it anyway. And I didn't have anything sophisticated to give them. So I just said, oh, shoot. And I turned around and I started writing on the whiteboard. And I said, on the whiteboard, I said, well, the first thing you got to do is you got to work hard. And I wrote the word work hard. And then underneath I said, you have to be honest. And I wrote the word honest. You have to be honest. And then I wrote the word opportunity. You have to take advantage of your opportunities. So basically, that's what the HOW formula is: honesty, opportunity, and work. And I said, those are the three things that you have to do to be successful in anything. And they just screamed and yelled. They said, wait a minute, is all we have to do is be honest and work hard and take advantage of our opportunities? What are we doing in school? And I said, well, you're here to get smarter. And they said, well, how come there's no smart in there? And I said, well, all right. So I drove, I erased the words that I wrote, and I drew a big circle. And I divided it into three parts. And then I put a little sliver right down here. And I put honesty, opportunity, and work. And in the sliver, I wrote a little blank line right there. And I said, you see this little sliver down here? There's 33% and 33% and 33% for honesty, opportunity, and work. You see this little sliver down here? 1%. You write anything you want on that line regarding smarts. Put whatever word you like. Brains, intelligence, smarts, knowledge, yeah, whatever.
Wisdom.
Yeah, wisdom, whatever. Okay, so I didn't completely leave out the element of smarts, because you'd have to be smart. But you don't have to be that smart, because I wasn't that smart. And I have enough self-awareness to admit that. So that's how I started. But you asked me how I started the book. That's how I started the
formula.
That's how I started the formula. But it didn't start then. I didn't make the formula up until after I decided to start writing a book. But I taught my students all the time, and my night class students, that's all you had to. I taught that the same three things for 13 years. Honesty, opportunity, and work, and smarts.
Yeah, every once in a while.
A little bit of smarts.
A little bit of smart. Yeah.
You need to be smarter. You're okay.
Of course, everybody wants to take the word opportunity and turn it into luck, but it's not. It's not luck. Opportunity is, okay, I have a good quote for you. This is a quote from a very famous guy. His name was Earl Nightingale. He was the late Earl Nightingale. He's an author and a businessman, and was known, I don't know where they came up with this, he was known as the Dean of Personal Development. And he had this statement, and I've got it in my book. Success is the progressive realization of worthy goals and ideals.
Say it again.
Success is the progressive realization of worthy goals and ideals.
So what does that mean to you?
It means success is not an event. It's an ongoing process, a work in process. You never should, in my opinion, you can have an event in your life and say, I'm successful and I've reached this event, I've accomplished this event. But if you accomplish that event and just say, this event has made me successful and I don't need to be any more successful, then you're making a big mistake. Because you'll never be able to sustain yourself on that event, unless that event has made you fabulously wealthy. Because what you will do now with that event is you'll start taking your wealth and you'll buy things. And you'll buy things that are not money generating. You'll buy things that are money spending. You'll buy homes, you'll buy cars, you'll buy boats. You'll do things that will make your successful event and your pile of wealth diminish and diminish and diminish until it's all gone. So success is the progressive realization of worthy goals and ideals. It means you need to stay successful. You need to keep progressively realizing or accomplishing more goals and ideals.
Yeah, you need to keep growing, keep becoming. I know that Benj and I talk a lot about this. About how we constantly want to be growing together, because we know that when we grow together, we'll be able to live the kind of life we want to live.
And we'll stay on the same
path, same level.
Whereas if one goes like that, you know, when we come to realization, it's going to be like, we don't even think the same. You know, we just are two different people.
A goal is you accomplish something. In other words, it's a terminal event. So that's your goal. You accomplish it. All right? But an ideal is not a terminal event. An ideal is a principle.
It's a state of being.
Yes. It's a principle. It's a value. It's a standard. It's things that you want to remain yourself, that you want to be. And it's part of what helps you make and accomplish worthy goals. If you have worthy ideals, you'll accomplish worthy goals. Success is the progressive realization of worthy goals and ideals.
And it's because your ideals are essentially who you are, right? And who you are will reflect the kind of goals that you want
exactly.
to set.
Exactly.
And your goals that you set are also going to put you towards the growth that you want. You know, for example, like I came up with this theory. I've told Sailor this. I don't think I've ever talked to you about this. I believe that there's three types of goals. There's growth goals, like individual growth, where it's like, I want to become this person. There's tangible goals, where it's like, I want to get a new house. And then I like to call them God goals, where it's like, the goal is so big that if God does not come down here and like pull me and literally like help me achieve this goal, then I can't get it. And the reason why I like to do that is because I believe that the kind of goals that stretch you the most are the kind of goals that are so big that they make you become a new person to hit them. So you could set a goal to be like, okay, I want to buy this new car. I've always had a dream to get this car. Well, if all you need is enough money to get that car, and you know if you work 5 years at this job, you'll have enough money to get that car. Okay, well, that's not you changing. You're not changing who you are to hit that goal. But big goals, God goals, you have to change into a different person to be able to hit that goal. And that's the way I like to set goals. So it kind of goes along with what you're saying.
Yeah, and I mean, you can always look back at your goals and see where you are at mentally and spiritually by the kind of goals you set. You know, if you really do want to become this Christ-like person, right, then you will set goals. Your goals will reflect what Christ has. I want to be kind in all instances. I want to be more understanding of people. I want to give to the poor. I want to give X to amount to this person or over here. Your goals reflect your spirituality. I really do believe in your spiritual health. And it's all part of the fact that your goals make you who you are. And at the end of the day, the Lord doesn't care about what you have or who you are around. The Lord cares about who you are at the end of your life and where you started out. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are given some very fortunate instances and do amazing things. And I will not discredit that in any way. But to take someone who is in a really hard situation with maybe no parents or some abusive parents, and for them to become a good mom, that is an amazing goal. And that is an amazing accomplishment that should never be looked down upon because of where they came from and how hard it is to really be a good mom when you didn't have a good mom in front of you all the time mm-hmm. when you're growing up. So it's all about who you're becoming and where you've been and where you are now.
Did you read that quote that I sent you on success? It said, success is not a goal, it's a result.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's always been... I don't know whether I made that up or heard it somewhere, but I always thought I made it up.
mm-hmm. Well, we really appreciate everything that you guys have shared with us while you've been here. I think there's a lot of value, specifically in this podcast, for every area of your life. Someone who's looking to improve their life, every aspect needs to listen to this podcast because that's what you guys did. You guys improved financially. You guys improved spiritually. You improved in your family. I mean, proved in who you guys are from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And we really appreciate you guys taking the time to share your story with us. I know sometimes it's not easy to share some stuff about your life, but I really do believe in the power of communicating to other people what you've done. And I really do believe that is a huge motivator for a lot of people
yes,
out there.
Yes, it helps.
Yeah.
Someday, show it to Emerald.
Oh, we will. You were downstairs and yes. We were filming this. We heard you on the flute.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think one of the most important things about our marriage is that we are not only in love with each other, but we are best friends and have been for
since
a long
we were 12.
Well, we weren't best. We were friends when we were 12, yeah. But we became best friends when we were in high school, and then we became sweethearts. And the word love is an important word. We're commanded to love, but we're not commanded to like. And I think like, in some ways, is a stronger word than love, because it's a choice.
I never thought about that before.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of fun together.
Oh, we know it.
Yes.
You guys travel around the country in your motorhome.
Yes.
Well, we can, not only that, but it's just who you guys are when you're with each other. You guys light each other up, and you guys are always very kind, and you guys know everything about each other, and
yes.
You help each other out in any way that you can, and that's what love is. It's not
support.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Sometimes we think we're too happy.
I don't think you could be.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that.
Well, thank you. We love you guys.
We love you.
We love you too.
Thank you.
But you're very grateful for everything that you've taught us and for your examples of who you are. And I would love to, in the future, do another one if you guys are up for it.
Sure.
Okay.
And talk about your book when it comes out a little bit more.
Uh-huh.
And, but yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for joining the Benj and Sailor Show. For all of our listeners out here, this is Carol and Charles Compass, and we are so excited to have them on here, and we really appreciate you guys. So thank you. And thanks for listening in.
Yeah, thank you.